We had an actual rainstorm in Salt Lake City this week. It wasn't much, but it's been hot, and we're in the middle of a very serious drought, so it seemed like something miraculous. And that kind of reaction is probably pretty ancient. These days, we check our weather apps for rain. In other times, they scan the horizon. Today, we're going to begin a series of conversations exploring the past, the present, and the future of drought, how people respond when the water dries up. And we're going to begin with the past. One of the droughts that we'll come to a little later in the program is what is known as the Great Drought of the 13th century. It started in the year 1276, and it devastated the communities of indigenous people living in the Four Corners region of the U.S. The naturalist and writer Craig Childs has explored the impact of this drought on the ancestral Pueblo people, and he's going to join us later on the program. But he told us about this conversation he had with Jim Enode, a Zuni elder and traditional farmer. They were talking about a rock art panel, petroglyphs that Jim had come across. Jim has seen a lot of these in his travels, but he told us this one was different. And as he looked it over, it made him sad.
I approached it. I said my greetings to it. How was your day? I do that because if I see those images and the work that someone had put in there on these panels of rocks, I knew that somebody was living nearby a long time ago. And they may be buried beneath this place where I'm standing on. They are still with us. I began to look at the petroglyphs in not too different of a way than somebody studying the impressionist kind of art. People would study the width of their brush strokes, how they place their brushes in certain ways, their concepts of space. I would do the same. I would look at the rock art and see each of these little pieces. I'd see the vigor, the robustness of a strike to make a mark on the stone. You see, wow, they really hammered that one in. And I saw where an earlier strike on the rock was hard and robust, and it dug in, it made a mark, and the next one did, and the next one. But it began to fade. You could tell in its depth, and it was getting lighter and lighter. I knew it was going to be a corn symbol, because I'm corn clan also, and there's just a way you make corn leaves. This artist had basically abbreviated it, made a couple strikes and then scratched it, and then started a couple leaf marks and then scratched it. They knew what it would entail to complete it. They just didn't complete it. I've come across petroglyphs that have fish, and there's turtles and water snakes and tadpoles and frogs. Obviously, looking all around in every direction, there's no water here. You know, my people, my great-great-great-grandparents for 600 generations have seen the climate change. Drier, wetter, hotter, cooler. And so we have these markers. They are etched in stone, painted in ceramics, and sometimes maybe woven into textiles. And within those patterns, there can be references, for example, to the times when it got too warm, it was too hot. And as I tried to put the whole story together, it seemed whoever was working on this rock art was, I think, really under some kind of duress, environmental duress. Maybe they were hungry, maybe thirsty. I went away from the petroglyphs, schooled. I learned something from that. I said, you know, sorry, but if it means anything to you, if it helps you to feel better, I said, I'm still here. The blood that was in your veins is in my veins.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Archaeologists and scholars could see clues in the ancient record. Something had to explain what seemed to be this wholesale collapse of some societies. Economies and political systems had disintegrated, and in droves, people abandoned these huge territories. But for years and years, they couldn't pin it down. And then the tools of science just got better and more refined, and this record started to become clear. When they were able to look deeply at sediment deposits in lakes and drip water in caves and growth rings in trees, scientists found the proof. It was drought. Devastating, relentless drought that had shaped the course of human history. Today in the program, we're talking about this history, and we're going to begin with the archaeologist, Harvey Weiss, from Yale.
Societies were forced to adapt to these mega drought situations. And that particular set of adaptations is really what we record in the historical record. But in several important cases, we really didn't understand why they were doing these things, why societies were moving in certain directions, either physically or ideologically, or why societies were changing their agricultural strategies, or even in many cases, why they were changing literally their belief systems. Now, as a result of the past 25 years of paleoclimate research, we've begun to understand that there were these repeated incidents of mega drought, which affected these societies. And in many cases, we literally did not know of the existence of these droughts in the archaeological or historical records. So now we know about them, and now we can actually see the ways in which societies reacted to and adapted to them.
One of the ways you've talked about all of this is like the ruins, for example, in places like in the Andes and the Mayan Yucatan and the Four Corners region of the American West. One of the ways you've sort of talked about this is that you've described them as monuments of construction, but also monuments of collapse. What do you mean?
Well, in all of those cases and in many others, the archaeological record that is visible on the surface of the earth consists of residences or public buildings which have been able to withstand the ages, that is, built of mud brick or stone, and which have for various reasons survived as the monuments of ancient living societies. But in many cases, these are also monuments of abandonment. They are the record of societies that literally left these places and left these buildings, these monuments, these constructions behind. For instance, if you go to the Yucatan of Mexico and you examine the ruins of ancient Mayan cities, you're looking at Mayan societies, what Mayan societies have left behind for us. But you're also looking at their abandonment. You're also looking at the process and the reasons that those cities are no longer occupied.
Your book explores nine past major mega droughts and the result on the societies there. There's from the Andes, from the Mayan Yucatan, from the Valley of Mexico, the Pueblo people in the Four Corners region. I wanted to ask you about some specifics of two of these that you explore, because the thing that interests me is just how abrupt they seem to have been. One is the second collapse of the Mayan culture, the empire, and one was the collapse of the Akkadian Empire in southern Mesopotamia. Let's start with the Mayan collapse, if we could. What's so interesting to me about this is it seems, if I'm getting this right, Professor, and sort of walk me through this, 850 AD, the Mayan lowlands, you say more than a million people in the course of a very short amount of time just left.
Yes. The famous Mayan droughts of the early 9th century were of what we now know to be really exceptional abruptness and severity, and persisted for decades. We now know that the abandonment of the central Mayan lowlands was also an event of great abruptness in response to the mega drought. There have been some very recent studies of the nature of the early 9th century droughts in the Maya region. And in particular, I'm thinking of the work of Evans and colleagues published in the journal Science in 2018. Actually, their calculations based upon their analysis of a lake sediment core allowed them to measure the abrupt reduction of precipitation up to perhaps 70%.
Wow.
Of prior precipitation. So just imagine the central wheat belt of the United States suddenly undergoing a 70% reduction in precipitation. End of rain-fed agriculture. So this is a pretty severe alteration in what is available for agriculture. And that, I think, is the essence of the problem, or the answer, the essence of the question globally, actually, with regard to mega drought. Once you take precipitation out of a region, it is essentially, under mega drought conditions, impossible for agriculture to persist. Once that agriculture ceases, resident societies have no choice under these mega drought conditions except to remove themselves to other places. And I believe this happened in the case of the central Maya lowlands, and of course, in the Near East, across Mesopotamia and adjacent territories, several millennia, several thousands of years earlier.
Right. Say something about that, if you would. One of the things you've written about is that around 2300 BC,
You're absolutely correct. Around 2200 BC, a very severe mega drought with great abruptness and magnitude and 2 or 2.5 century duration. A great mega drought befell the area between essentially Spain and India. This mega drought severely disrupted the rain-fed agriculture regions of ancient Mesopotamia and the societies which were dependent upon rain-fed agriculture. When that rain-fed agriculture was no longer possible, these societies were forced to abandon those territories and move to others. But we never knew why these things were happening. Why were people abandoning one region and moving into another? Why was there, for instance, a sudden in-migration into southernmost Mesopotamia beginning about 2200 BC? Well, southernmost Mesopotamia is actually sustained by irrigation agriculture. So while one region was suffering mega drought affecting its rain-fed agriculture, another adjacent region was still practicing irrigation agriculture and was the attractor region for the populations displaced from the rain-fed agriculture. So we observe this archaeologically and historically. We see peoples moving around. We see peoples moving into new regions, but we don't really understand why. And we just call it, well, that's what happened.
Yeah.
And now we're beginning to understand why these population movements occurred at those times in those places.
They're chasing rain.
They're chasing water. Yeah. Wow. They're chasing sustainable agriculture.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is a process that we are familiar with even in our own day.
Right. It's interesting, too, in the story of the Akkadian drought, you know, the North Mesopotamian landscape. You mentioned in your writing that some 30 years after they abandoned the region, the precipitation returns. So I guess this is obvious. The people come back.
Well, actually, no. It's not 30. It's 300.
300. Yes.
Right. Yeah. We also observe... Well, we observe now, first archaeologically, the abandonment of large swaths of agricultural territory. And now archaeologically, we also observe the reintroduction of agricultural peoples at the termination of this drought and the return of precipitation. So we didn't understand why this was happening either. We didn't understand that there was a drought, and we didn't understand why suddenly this region is repopulated. So it's the return of precipitation that we can also document in the paleoclimate records. It's a pretty remarkable record.
Yeah. Professor, I'm not sure what you can tell just from the paleoclimate record, but I was wondering, what do you know, do you think? What was the understanding of the societies who were experiencing these mega droughts? That is, how did they understand what was going on? How much of this was based on just their kind of superstition, not a deep comprehension of earth science, or was there some kind of collective knowledge or experience that gave them a more, you know, significant insight for what was going on? Can we tell?
Actually, it's pretty much a mystery. We can't really tell. We don't have the available records of these societies that abandoned these territories. We don't have written records that reveal to us what these people were thinking or knowing at these regions' abandonments. So it's really kind of a mystery.
What about to the question of how people reacted to these collapses? Can we discern that there was, there must have been social disintegration, political disintegration. Does the record tell us anything about violence? Did the rank and file, for example, turn on their leaders? Can we see any of that?
Not very clearly.
Yeah.
What we do see is essentially massive population movements. And in some very outstanding situations, we see the movement of people who are identified as pastoral nomads, sheep herding, non-sedentary peoples, moving out of northern regions and literally moving into southern regions in ways that the southern people found extremely disturbing, such that the kings of the southern regions actually boast about creating walls to hold back the nomads.
Wow.
And literally, in one outstanding case, literally name the wall. I created this wall, and the name of this wall is the wall that holds back, that repels the nomads.
Wow.
This is a very, climate refugee situation.
Yeah.
That has rather particular resonance in our own time.
There's this question of whether these mega droughts just happened to these societies, were natural, or whether they contributed to them in some way, through waste or bad practices or policy. What do we know about that?
That's a very intriguing question. Actually, there is a profoundly different situation that we and our globe, our Earth, finds itself in at this moment, and these ancient situations that we're talking about. In all cases, these ancient situations were completely natural. That is, humans did not contribute to these mega drought situations. Their causes were completely natural and not human related. And of course, the situation today is completely the opposite.
Yeah. There's another contrast that you've mentioned, that you've talked about, that was different for the people who are experiencing mega droughts, 1,000 years ago, and the experience of today. And one of them was what you described as an erosion of conscious self-determinism.
Yes.
Do you mind saying something about that?
Yes, what I referred to as the erosion of conscious self-determinism is precisely this naturalness and not human-inducedness of these ancient mega droughts. We tend to think historically that we are in charge.
Yeah.
that we determine our fate, that we control the natural world around us. And I think one of the important lessons that we learn from the past and from our new knowledge of mega drought is that, in fact, in the past, it was not always the case at all that we were in charge or that we were controlling our destiny or that we were self-determining. Yeah. These mega droughts were natural, and they were literally beyond the control of the populations affected by them. Did I help to explain that a bit?
You did. And I just, because it seems important that we think about it in terms that help us understand the way we think about the role that we play. That seems important. Yeah. Is that right? Do you think?
Yes, I do. Yeah. Perhaps if we put this in modern terms, we are not completely in charge of what is happening in the western part of the United States, the southwestern part of the United States at this time. We are in the process of experiencing a mega drought in that region, and we are not completely in control of that process. Hmm. We may in part be in control of that process, but in large measure, it seems that we are not. We don't really have the means to terminate this mega drought process. We're not in charge. These are natural forces. Of course, there are ways in which we can adapt to this situation. We can all leave California and move to Oregon and Washington. There's a project. Right. Or we can all stop the cultivation of almonds and almond groves that suck up a lot of water. But there are some limits to this, and mega drought is a pretty demanding situation that is sufficient. It really terminates agriculture, and that's kind of a frightening prospect.
So what do you see? I'm not sure if you've thought much about just what is the future of agriculture in the West, for example? Because the implications seem fairly dire if you look just at the example of history.
Yeah, the implications are pretty dire. And I think one of the great knowledge frontiers right at this moment is, where is this going? Where is this drought going? How long will this persist? And what can we possibly do to sustain ourselves through it? I don't think anybody really has the answer to that question at this moment, which is why it's a little bit frightening and why it raises this issue about conscious self-determinism. Are we really in charge here?
Yeah.
Well, it seems like the forces of nature are in charge. And it seems that we do not fully understand the forces of nature at this juncture. What are the forces making for controlling, intensifying, magnifying, extending the duration of this drought event in the Western United States? We do not understand that.
Yeah.
In fact, the mega drought history of the Earth's surface, the mega drought history of those mega droughts that so affected ancient societies, even extending into medieval times, we really do not understand what actually caused these mega droughts, what alterations in the atmosphere and ocean systems of the Earth's surface, what changed such that these mega droughts occurred. It's a big research frontier.
But you're not suggesting, Professor, that by saying that this is a natural process now, the mega drought that we're experiencing now is natural, but that doesn't – you're not suggesting that that doesn't mean human behavior not just accelerated it but may have even gotten it started? How do you account for that?
Well, it's extremely possible, and many climate scientists have argued that the abruptness and magnitude of the present mega drought onset may have been encouraged or prompted or heightened or accelerated by the global warming that is taking place right now.
Right.
The relative importance of global warming within the causal chain that resulted in this mega drought is pretty much under investigation and yet uncertain. We don't really know, in my humble opinion.
Let me ask you finally, one of the things that you have said, I wanted you to just emphasize this point finally. We can't understand what's happening today, you say, if we don't understand the past, if we don't look at the paleoclimate record. Say something about that finally, how important it is for us to understand what happened before to get a sense of what's happening now.
I think it's very important for us to understand the paleoclimate record, which tells us of the continued appearance, the continued onset of mega drought conditions over the centuries, over the past several thousand years, over the course of the entire post-glacial period, the past 11,700 years. I think it's important for us to understand that these mega droughts actually occurred, that they were abrupt onset, that they were severe, and that they lasted not only in some cases for several decades, but actually in several cases for several centuries. So it's very important for us to understand there are natural forces at work that we didn't previously know about and for which we need to be prepared, for which we need to understand perhaps what is going on and what our options are. The ability, for instance, to transfer agricultural technologies, to transfer agricultural populations, to transfer agricultural production, and to be aware of the needs in situations such as that of the Western United States at this time, be aware of the needs which we may incur as these situations develop. This mega drought situation may persist, in which case we've got to become a bit creative and a bit thoughtful about the ways in which these situations developed in the past.
Dr. Harvey Weiss, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
Harvey Weiss, he's a professor of Near Eastern Archaeology at Yale University, editor of the book Mega Drought and Collapse. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Hi, this is Noelle King from NPR. There's a lot to keep up with in the news, and one way you can help? Donate that vehicle you're not using anymore. It could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Thank you, and here's how to get started.
KUER accepts all kinds of vehicles, including SUVs, trucks, RVs, and even boats. Plus, the process is easy. We'll handle everything, from the free pickup to the donation receipt. You can get started at KUER.org/vehicle.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're exploring the history of drought, of these mega droughts and their effect on the people who experienced them. One of the mega droughts that interested us was, of course, the one that hit the Four Corners region in the 13th century. That one seemed to cause the civilization of cliff dwellers and farmers known as the ancestral Pueblo people to just vanish. The naturalist Craig Childs writes about it in his book, House of Rain. And in the book, he says, inventing the world of these people from what we now see on the ground is a flight of imagination.
You've got to take all these bits and pieces, archaeological data, seeing remnants of ruin blocks, you know, rubbled hills and cliff dwellings, and you have to look beyond just what's on the surface and see humans. You know, they're not there. And so you have to take those extra steps and put the lives back into place. You have to look at a room and see that there's hair on the floor, human hair from people combing their hair in a room. And then you can see those people in their actions, in their daily actions, because you're doing the same thing now, granted, we live really different lives, but at the root, it's humans doing things, washing dishes, leaving your shoes by the door. And you just have to extrapolate. You have to imagine, jump into a world that hasn't been there for 1,000 years, and make it human again.
One of the things you said once about the sort of lessons you were trying to take from the Pueblo people was that when you would take your own family out into the desert, you had to take care of them. You had to move them from one place to another. You had to worry about them. And that gave you a sense of how this people, this ancient people, was more than an abstract idea. It became real to you, you said.
Yeah. Well, kids help with that because you're having to watch them and take care of them and plotting out your day or your week, your month, your year based on what they need. And you think, oh, they were doing the exact same thing. I mean, just recently I was at a panel in Northern Arizona of rock art, and it was all children's handprints. Hmm. And you see those and you know what's involved. The kids have not changed in that time. They have the same general needs, and you're looking at your experience and applying it to theirs. You're seeing them as human as you are, as human as anybody is, and you just kind of have to erase the time difference between here and there and say, well, 1,000 years doesn't make them inhuman. It's not like they're from some primitive, multi-million year old past. This is, evolutionarily, 1,000 years is nothing. Yeah, new technology or whatever, but same social structures, ways of talking, ways of listening, laughter, crying. I think about that a lot. I've been to sites where children were buried, graves, and I can't help but think, oh, those parents were weeping. They were on their hands and knees. They were real.
The other thing I think you mentioned is that you got a sense of the fact that they were in this constant sense of motion that, as you say in the book, rarely would a person have been born and then grown old and then died in the same place, that they were basically chasing the rain, is how you put it.
Yeah, which I think is probably the way to live out here, at least on that scale, is, slight variations, an inch or two less or more of rain a year would change the entire scene. We see it right now, but we've got reservoirs and huge infrastructure so that we can kind of skirt by it a bit more. But they were really dependent on every storm that came through. So when climate shifted, which it does, in the Southwest, I think this is one of the canary in the coal mine environments because it shifts so readily. One year can be very, very different from another. And so you have to be ready to say, okay, this isn't going to work here anymore. We can go up onto a mesa nearby, where it's warmer or cooler or wetter or whatever it is. I think they had this place mapped out by microclimates, and they moved from one to the next over, decades, centuries. They were in motion often.
I wanted to ask you about, I guess they're kind of, their spiritual idea that related to water, that related to rain. What do you see in the rock arts? What do we know about their mythology that explains how important water is?
Well, in a way, I think all the rock art is about water. Huh. Without rain, nothing happens at all. And the more I've learned about it, the more I've talked to people who study ethnography and, read the old ethnography texts from a century ago and talk to people at Hopi and Zuni, Navajo, Ute, I get the picture that the rock art is really all about water. Figures, big red painted human-like figures that I always took to be, ghosts or spirit humans of some sort. I'm learning more and more that they're representations of clouds or thunder beings, lightning beings. And that's how they were expressed. I was down at Hopi not long ago looking at a series of panels where you could see cloud petroglyphs that actually looked like clouds with lightning coming out of them. And those were more recent in the last couple hundred years. If you go back 1,000 years, it's not that one-to-one depiction. It's more of an animist culture. So that when they're depicting a cloud, it's a being, it's a person. And, you know, there's one outside of Moab that I've been writing about lately that's a figure that has a red figure, tall human, you know, about life size, that has a snake in its mouth and looks very much like the historic snake dance, which is a rain dance that's known at Hopi. And you look into the body of this figure and it's all these long red thumb streaks of hematite. And you realize, oh, this body is full of rain. That's what is being depicted here. And everything around it, snakes are associated with rain because they're often around springs, or they're considered messengers between this world and the spirit world where rain resides. So I think rain is showing up in almost everything that I'm seeing out there.
You know, one of the things that we talked with Professor Weiss about was that there were moments of mega drought in human history where it came really abruptly and it emptied out these societies. It emptied them out, and pretty quickly.
Yeah.
You don't think that that's what happened with the ancestral Pueblan people. You think that it was a more gradual kind of experience. Is that right?
Yeah, they knew how to work within these systems. So they knew
why,
how to respond.
Because dry conditions were just a part of life. You had to adapt constantly, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and a question I often hear is, well, what was it like back then? It must have been much more lush and, you know, a lot more rain for there to be so many cliff dwellings and pueblos and everything. And I go, no, it's pretty much like it is now. You know, 1 year dry, 1 year not as dry.
Right.
So they had systems in place. They were accustomed to migration and movement, and they knew where to go. So it wouldn't have necessarily been like a bomb dropping on them, because they've seen this bomb before. They know how to defuse it or how to deflect it. They knew how to live with drought. They still do. I mean, they're still here. They've figured this out. They figured it out thousands of years ago.
Yeah. So when it got really bad, though, let's talk about that, because that seems like a connection that we're all experiencing now. You talk about the fact that, okay, they were used to this. They had systems in place. But when things got really bad, when they finally decided this might not work, I'm interested in that period between when some decided to actually go someplace else and how long they, you know, and those who decided they were going to stay, because you have talked about there being this real sense of tension and anxiety, and it seems like a lot of violence during that time.
Yeah, I don't think even if they had systems in place, I don't think it was ever easy.
Yeah,
you know, when I bring up migration to people at Hopi, and you know, I just throw the word around as an archaeological term, they say, "Whoa, hold on there, migration. That's not something anybody wants to do. People die in migration." Clans disappear. Things are hard, and I think there's going to be a resistance, but there are plenty of stories of pueblos that split over it. That some people say, you know, we're getting out of here, and some say, no, we can hold on. It's not this monolithic culture making one big decision.
Yeah.
And in that period that you're asking about, I think it was extremely difficult. You know, bones are showing. Human bones showing signs of malnourishment and signs of violence, a lot of signs of violence, projectiles wedged into people's bones, skulls with holes in them the size of axes, stone axes. So there's a period of decay, collapse that they went through.
You say the archaeological record from the 13th century around the Four Corners region reads like a war crimes indictment.
Yeah, some of the sites are you know, large pueblos that have been massacred, and human bodies left out on the ground, not buried. So you can see that, and not just warfare, but people all packed together in a room, killed in the room. So terrible things happen, which, you know, I wouldn't want to say that, oh, this is just the Pueblo world. It's the human world. When I see this, I go, oh, that makes sense. This is what people do. This is these moments in history happen.
Craig Childs. He's the author of a number of books, including House of Rain, Tracking a Vanished Civilization Across the American Southwest. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER's statewide service stays strong thanks to the listeners who also contribute to the station every month. Our nearly 9,000 sustaining members provide the most reliable source of income for the station, so we can bring you trustworthy news and information. If you value our commercial-free programming, consider becoming a KUER sustainer, with a recurring gift starting at just $5 a month, or increase your existing pledge. Just go to KUER.org/donate. And thanks for your support.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today, we're beginning a series of programs on the past, present, and future of drought. For obvious reasons, if you're listening in the Intermountain West, you know you're in a mega drought. And to understand it, it might help to hear the stories of those who experienced it in the ancient past. The writer and naturalist Craig Childs is with us, taking us through the mega drought, or Great Drought, as it's called, from the 13th century that took down the ancestral Pueblo people in the Four Corners region. Childs told us that the drought changed these people. They went from a community that traded with others that had political and religious centers to one that was more utilitarian and more defensive.
I think that the height of things when you see, you know, a lot of pilgrimage sites, people coming from long distance, trade going on, you see more hierarchy. And I think that's when there's plenty of rain and everything's going great. And the priests are calling for rain and it's coming. I imagine people feel pretty good about things at that moment. And pretty big, you know, they feel like they have a big place on the land. And then the times in between are rougher. They are more utilitarian. I imagine that there is a point where some people are going, hey, these rain priests, they're not cutting it. This isn't happening. And so even that kind of cultural foundation comes apart. And I hear that when I talk to folks from modern Pueblos who look back at that time, especially the time like when Chaco was big in New Mexico and there was, you know, it was abundance. And they say, you know what? We went too far. We were too big. We were too, we were full of hubris. And that's why we've learned to be more quiet about it, more gentle, because we just took it off the charts and the whole thing fell apart.
I guess this is what you mean then when you talk about the fact that it wasn't necessarily the drought that did these societies in. It was upheaval, because you said this is a human problem. It was spurred on by climate change for sure, but this is a human problem.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that really fascinates me about, especially the 1200s when the Four Corners were abandoned, or when people migrated out of here. There weren't a lot of people left behind, and there was still water here. It wasn't like the place went completely dry. I mean, some of these springs, even on hard years, are still flowing. You could still have a community. People could have remained, not all of them. And yet it looks like, at least in the Pueblos, nobody remained. Every single person left. And to me, that implies, yeah, climate, drought had a lot to do with it as you know, the starting factor, but humans are the ones who finished it up. Society, couldn't hold together in place, or maybe the place was bad and had to be left. I think that's something that they were used to going through, that they'd live in a place for 10, 15 years, and they'd use up the farmlands around there as you would in that time frame, and they say, okay, now we go to this other place. And so they would have some kind of system where they would be able to depart and say, okay, we're not going to live here anymore. We may come back, but we're not going to live here. And I think it happened on just a huge scale in the Four Corners, where they said, this place is no longer a dwelling place. And it is no longer good to be here. And we now need to get out of here.
It's interesting that you take a lesson from that for today, that we're in this moment of drought. And that we need to be creative. We need to be adaptable, like it seems they were. And, you know, you've talked about how we're kind of in a trickier place now because we're so settled. And I wanted you to talk about that finally, just the idea of that we have these, you know, these regulations. But you're saying we need to rethink it in some ways, be more, if it's possible, I suppose, more mobile, more willing to adapt. Is that right?
Yeah, I think there are lessons, even though we live in a really different manner. It's, you can't really pick up Salt Lake City and right. move it to the Pacific Northwest. Yeah. It's a difficult time to figure out what to do, but the Southwest and the Colorado Plateau in particular is really fickle. There are places that will continue getting snow and rain while, 100 miles away, you're not getting anything. Yeah. It's just how this land works. So I think we need to be putting our weight in different places. We need to be able to shift and say, okay, so, the northern Colorado is getting all the rain right now and southern Arizona isn't, or whatever. So they're up in the north, they're doing water storage and they're using their water. And in the south, they're going on restrictions. I mean, it's just that you can't have a blanket policy in a place like this. There are plenty of other landscapes in North America where a blanket policy works. The Midwest has larger aquifers. The East has rivers that are continually flowing. Here, one river will drop to a trickle. I mean, the Dolores River right now, coming out of southwest Colorado, there are places where it's really not flowing. It's just rock. And meanwhile, the Colorado River is moving and it's reaching its spring peak. So I think we've got to be able to shift geographically and not necessarily move from place to place. Maybe that ultimately becomes an issue. But right now it's who's getting water and who's not. And that doesn't mean go to who's getting water and move their water to us. I think that creates another problem. It's just, if you're in one of the dry zones, behave differently. I think we need to behave differently year to year and season to season based on what's going on. And that's not what we're used to. We're used to kind of a homogenous way of dealing with our geographies. And I think that time is past us, and that time isn't going to do us any favors. Hmm.
You believe that the ancestral Pueblan people thought they might be coming back. What does that tell you?
Well, that history changes. I've been at excavations where there's a site that has a certain date, and then you dig down to the bottom of it, and there's no sign of anybody. So you've gotten below that site, and then you dig down further, and you find, oh, there's a site here 700 years earlier, and it looks like the same people. So they're accustomed to leaving for not just for seasons or decades, but for centuries. And so when I see that pattern, I think, oh, when they left the Four Corners, they kept this. This is their ancestral landscape. This is one of their places. And I imagine they would have moved back here, 300 years ago, 200 years ago, because we've had a good couple centuries of rain, and they would have done it all over again at a new level, except the world changed. Athabascans came down from the north. Navajo really made a they made a homeland. Then, you know, the Spanish, then the rest of Europe, the rest of the world. So I think they would have been back. I think the sites that, you know, Mesa Verde and Hovenweep and so many places would have had people living in them again, because their trajectory is long. And I think it will happen again. I think if you came back in 1,000 years, you might find a full Pueblo occupation in the Four Corners.
Craig Childs, thanks very much.
Oh, thank you, Doug. Glad to be back.
Craig Childs is the author of the book House of Rain, Tracking a Vanished Civilization Across the American Southwest. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Carter Wolf is our intern. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.